My name is Byron Santangelo. I am serving as the director of the Kansas African Studies Center at KU, and I'm a professor of English and Environmental Studies. This forum is a central component of a larger project focused on facilitating the creation and spread of stories about African immigration in the Midwest and in the U.S. more generally. The hope is that the project will highlight the value of stories for productive dialogue and the value of sharing stories for reframing public discussions about immigration. The questions that we're focused on, and when we were developing this grant, this was our focus, was what are different stories about immigration and how can those stories be accessed? How can stories that have been unheard be made accessible? How might stories enable productive dialogue in the production of more stories? And how do people's stories about themselves change through the experience of immigration? And how do stories about the communities tell about themselves change through the process or the experience of immigration? The Migration Stories Project is co-directed by me and the regular director of the Kansas African Studies Center, Liz McGonigal. Both the Migration Stories Project and this forum are funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities as part of their Humanities in the Public Square initiative. This initiative is intended to draw on the humanities as a means to enable community dialogue about pressing controversial social issues. In addition to this forum, we'll be running workshops in the months to come focused on storytelling, poetry, theater, and the visual arts. And we will be working with the Kansas Humanities Council and the Kansas City Public Radio Station, KCUR, on radio shows as well as book and film discussions. An important part of the initiative, of our initiative, is to collect stories about immigration both from immigrants and from members of host communities. If you're interested in sharing your story, please visit our project website, www.migrationstories.ku.edu. Our program will begin about the first hour with three presentations by our speakers, Marta Caminero Santangelo, Garth Myers, and Chris Abani. The second half will focus on questions and comments with the audience. And what we're hoping is that this will actually develop into a kind of dialogue or discussion. So our first speaker today is Marta Caminero Santangelo. She's a professor of English at KU, working on issues of Latino migrant experiences and human rights. She's been designated a KU Woman of Distinction and received a prestigious Kimper Fellowship for Teaching Excellence at KU. She's the author of three books and numerous articles. Her most recent book, Documenting the Undocumented, Latino Narratives and Social Justice in the Era of Operation Gatekeeper from the University of Florida Press, focuses on the ways that writers express solidarity with undocumented immigrants. Documenting the Undocumented also focuses on bringing immigrant voices that have been silenced back into debates about immigration. Today she's going to be speaking to us about how migrants redefine what it means to be American by telling distinctly American stories. Please join me in welcoming Marta.
Thank you, everybody. I'm so happy to be here. And thank you all for coming. I'm the lucky one who gets to go first. So as a way of opening up this conversation and tagging along to what Byron just said, I'd really like to focus on the importance of telling stories for political and social work. I'm a lit professor, so stories are what I do. And I'd like to start out by just pointing out that there's been quite a bit of scholarship recently that points out that activism and human rights really depend on the telling of stories, on oral histories, testimonies, life stories, because precisely they give a face, they give some concrete reality to issues that can otherwise seem really abstract and complex. But once you start talking about storytelling for activism, you get pretty quickly to the question of who gets to tell the story. And my research, as Byron said, focuses on Latino studies, and in the past several years, it's focused very specifically on stories about undocumented immigration. And so I'm hoping today to use that as a case study for sort of looking at the political and social power of stories. But as you might guess, historically, the undocumented aren't necessarily the first group that comes to mind as wanting to tell their stories for political and social activism, because you risk pretty immediately the threat of deportation if you tell your story openly. And also, when we think of the public square or the public sphere, there's no particular official platform, there's no particular venue for undocumented immigrants to tell their stories publicly and be heard. So there's no particular outlet for undocumented immigrants to tell their stories and have a hearing. But today I want to talk about dream activists, they call themselves dreamers, who are probably the most vocal group of undocumented immigrants thus far to come out and actually tell their stories. And they're the most politically savvy about the power of storytelling. And just in case you're not super familiar with the Dream Act, versions of which have been proposed since 2001, the basic premise is that it would give an avenue of legalization and perhaps eventual citizenship for undocumented immigrants who came here as children, have lived here many years, have established a good character, graduate from high school or get their GED, and then spend at least two years in college or in military service. There have been various versions over the years, but they all basically maintain these parameters. And just to give you a sense of how African immigration fits into this, we tend to think of undocumented immigration as largely a Latino, Latin American issue, and it is a majority Latino, Latin American issue, but of course undocumented immigrants come from a wide variety of countries and regions. This is the population, as far as I can find, of estimated African undocumented immigrants in the U.S., and then the population that's eligible for DACA, which is deferred, forgetting what the acronym is.
Deferred action.
Deferred action for children arrivals, which is Obama's policy of forestalling deportation for basically people who would have qualified for the Dream Act. So if you came here as a child, you've been here with continuous presence in the U.S. and so on, you can qualify for deferred action for 2 years, renewable. But it's a policy, it's not a law, so if somebody other than Obama got to be president, who knows what would happen. But the population eligible for DACA is roughly the same as the population of people who would be eligible for the Dream Act. So you can see that that's the percentage of total African undocumented immigrants. And in case you're interested, there's a breakdown of Kansas and Missouri undocumented immigrants. The issue as undocumented activists, dream activists, tell their stories is that they're really emphasizing, first of all, representing themselves and telling their own stories in response to, you know, a decade and a half of deportations during the era of George W. Bush. There were large-scale workplace raids. And they really want to emphasize the issue of telling their own stories for political effect. I interviewed several dreamers in 2010-2011, and I want to read you some of their words. Tamara says, "It wasn't until I started organizing with a group of undocumented people that I realized that what was missing from my organizing before was a clear perspective that it should be undocumented people who are at the head of the movement. Because the group that I'm in now and that I helped start is precisely a group where we want to say that it's about undocumented young people leading and their decisions, our decisions, being respected." So you can kind of hear in Tamara's words that she's insisting on taking back the public square, that if the public square is a place where undocumented immigrants haven't been given a voice or been given a platform where they can be heard, Tamara really wants to insist, no, you really need to listen to us. We're the ones who know about our situation and can best tell our stories. And another undocumented immigrant that I interviewed, Cesar, said pretty much the same general theme. "Many don't understand why we've come to this country in the first place, or the root causes of migration, and they don't hear enough about stories such as mine. They don't understand just seeing around that age, and he's talking about high school, seeing around that age the things on the media, I just knew that this isn't right. And I knew that as immigrants, wait a minute, where's our voice in this whole everything that's going on? And so that's when I decided, you know what? I need to share my story. Because it's stories like mine that will change people's minds and hearts. Undocumented immigrant dreamers, one of their slogans is coming out of the shadows. Another is undocumented and unafraid. And the basic idea is that you declare your undocumented status openly, you tell your story and you identify yourself for political purposes, and you tell it in as many venues as you possibly can. So there are websites, there are videos on YouTube, some of which I'm going to share with you, there are blogs, they share their stories on social media. The basic idea is really to tell your story as a form of political activism. This is a poster that was put out by the National Immigrant Youth Alliance, which also has put out a guide to coming out that used to be available on the web. And the guide would sort of outline various different levels at which you could tell your story for undocumented immigrant dreamers, would-be dreamers. And basically say, look, we're a community, we're here, you're not alone, there's more than one of you, we can offer support, we can offer guidelines, come out and tell your story. And then there were various different levels at which you could tell your story, starting with, you know, friends and family, immediate community members, and then going on to, for example, level four is a rally. And every year since about 2002, undocumented immigrants from across the nation have been showing up in Washington, D.C. in June to protest and rally and advocate for the DREAM Act. They hold mock graduations to call attention to the fact that they graduate from high school, but then many of them cannot afford to attend college because they're not eligible for financial aid, or often for in-state tuition, depending on what state they're in. They've collected their stories in volumes such as this one, Papers, Stories by Undocumented Youth, and they've also created documentaries. And in March of this year, they actually presented an amicus brief to the Supreme Court. So you can see that they really, DREAM activists really see their stories, their personal stories, as being told for political purposes. But because of that, they're often focusing on what is common to dreamers, to undocumented youth. So their stories tend, as they develop and as they get repeated, to focus on elements that are common to the struggle, rather than so much the differences. So differences of national origin don't get emphasized. What gets emphasized is things like the obstacles that hold them back, when they realize they're undocumented, what they hoped to do, what they can't do, and the common group identity among them. They identify, I would venture a generalization, that they identify publicly, first and foremost, as dreamers, rather than as Mexican, Venezuelan, African. One woman, Katrina, that I interviewed, who is actually an immigrant from Nigeria who came to the U.S. when she was 5 or 6 years old, described her process this way. In junior year of high school, we started to take our first advanced placement tests and things like that, and the college discussion started. So I looked up their applications, and then I noticed they had your basic identification information, but then they also had, for citizenship status, it was, are you a citizen, are you a permanent resident, or are you an international student? And those were the only three options. And our family had never really talked about immigration stuff. All I knew was our immigration status was pending. That's all I'd been told. That's all I really knew. So with that application, I was just like, well, I'm not really in any category, and there's no other box. So it seems like from hearing other dreamer stories, it's the moment that you kind of realize you're a dreamer, even though you don't know you're a dreamer yet, and you don't call it being a dreamer, it's still kind of the first time that most of us are just like, well, there is no box for me. So I don't really know what to do. And maybe you can hear in her words how she's really emphasizing the formation of a group identity, even before she really knew that it was a group identity. What she's emphasizing is the commonality of experience, and in retrospect, the group identity gives her a vocabulary to talk about that experience. I'm going to show you two videos that are available on YouTube just to sort of underscore the potential commonalities of the story, despite wide varieties of national origin and culture. The first one is Carlos, who immigrated from Venezuela. Solu Lumihu is Nigerian and came to the United States when she was 14. We can maybe pick up some of the same elements from her story. And here you can see Tolu Olubumi introducing Obama, actually, at a White House event in 2013 for immigration reform. So once again, these stories really have had a lot of influence on Obama, on policy, and they've been quite persuasive with some politicians for the DREAM Act. Maybe you could hear some of the similarities in their stories. They both focus on lack of criminal intent and legitimate ties to the U.S. Carlos's father, grandfather was an American citizen. Tolu says, we came here, but we had no intention of being undocumented. They focus on issues of merit, Carlos, and wanting to give back to American society. So Carlos wanted to enlist in the military, and Tolu wanted to be an engineer. They really want to contribute meaningfully, but their goals and ambitions are thwarted because of their status. And then they also focus, instead of focusing on the narrative of their family members making an illegal decision, they focus on family sacrifice and the things that their family had to give up for them to be here, including in Tolu's case, not being able to go back to be with her father when he died. This last one is also a Nigerian immigrant and a leader in the DREAM activist movement, Kemi Bello, and it takes a slightly different tone. You probably hear from Kemi's words that she's trying to turn around the threat of telling your story as an undocumented person and saying, you know, no matter how much we live in the shadows, we're always at risk. So why not tell your story? Because at least when you tell your story, people know who you are, they know your story. It's harder to disappear. And I think that's a really interesting turn on it, right? Telling your story is a way not to disappear. So I want to end with the words of James, who was another undocumented dreamer that I interviewed. And James was actually eventually able to become legalized because his stepmother was a U.S. citizen and she sponsored him. But he described for me the feeling that he had when he received his green card in the mail. And it really speaks to this issue of somehow not being recognized, not kind of being disappeared in your own country in the U.S. He says, because the day that the letter came in the mail, you know, it's a letter that says, welcome to the United States of America. And it comes with your green card. And when I got that, I really only just started crying. It felt very insulting to me that only after 13, 14 years was I going to begin to be acknowledged in the country that I called home and that I loved.
Our next speaker tonight is Garth Myers. He is the Paul Rather Distinguished Professor of Urban International Studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He served as the director of the Kansas African Studies Center for 5 years during his almost 20 years as a professor of geography and African-American studies at KU. Garth is an expert on African urban experience and has written on the contributions of Africans in the diaspora to the making of American urban identities. He's the author or editor of 6 books and received the Association of American Geographers Distinguished Award for Scholarship on Africa. There has been scant attention to African immigration in the Midwest, and in fact, Garth was the first scholar to examine African immigrant experience in Kansas in his article, Tanzanians in the Land of Oz, which focuses on African immigrants in Wichita, Kansas. He also co-directed a Kansas Humanities Council grant project entitled Identity, Voice, and Community Among New African Immigrants to Kansas. I will add that Garth is a particular apt person to have on this panel as someone who both loves telling and hearing stories, a lover of stories. Today, he will be providing us with context to consider when addressing the topic of recent African immigration. Please join me in welcoming Garth.
Thank you very much, Byron. Nice to be back here in town, see a lot of familiar faces, and to be returning to a research topic of great interest to me. on geographies of African migration to the United States and the significant role of Midwestern cities and towns. What I want to do tonight is to first give an overview on the contemporary era of voluntary migration from Africa to the US, the geography of this migration stream, and then delineate some of the diversity and complexity. And those of you who know me will know that whenever I give a talk about Africa, in quotes, I'm ever mindful of reminding myself and everyone that Africa is huge, diverse, and complex. We're talking about a continent that's the second largest one on Earth, more than 50 independent countries, more than 2,000 distinct languages, and therefore many dissimilarities across the continent. So after talking through some of the broad general characteristics, I also want to hint at some key themes that we can discuss in relation to the variety of these migration stories, and then to give you some examples of those stories. Voluntary migration from African countries has grown steadily in volume and significance since at least the 1970s. There are many push and pull factors behind this, and in each country of origin, there are different causative factors. For example, the largest communities in the U.S. who began coming to the U.S. earlier and in larger numbers are Nigerians, Egyptians, and Ethiopians. These are the largest source countries by a long shot, still, for Africans in America in contemporary times. A great many came and continue to arrive for educational opportunities, but at various times, different sorts of political economic crises in these countries have spurred spikes in migration. Be that as it may, we also see that Africans are now more than 5% of the foreign-born population in the United States. In other words, more than 5% of the people born in other countries who live in the United States were born in African countries. And there are many more Africans in America who are the children and even grandchildren of the earlier migrants of this new wave. Think, for example, if you're obsessed with sports as I am, about many first and second and even third generation Nigerian Americans in particular regularly appear on the rosters of university and professional sports teams in many different sports. There are many migration stories, therefore, that are very much American stories now. When we look at the geography of settlement in the U.S., the first and most obvious thing that we see is that the largest African populations are in the largest cities, and typically the cities of the most common arrival of people flying in from Africa. This is DC, New York, Boston, Atlanta, and then secondarily, because they're a little further away, Chicago or Houston, with somewhat smaller populations on the West Coast in cities like LA, San Francisco, and Seattle. But there's an increasing diversity to this, as many African migrants now settle or resettle in small to mid-sized cities or towns, often in the middle of the country, and even some rather small towns. This is a chart that's probably too small to read, so I'm just going to point out some highlights on it. It shows the African-born population in the metropolitan areas of the U.S. as of 2012 by the census, and I want you to keep in mind these are documented foreign-born Africans, so the population that Martha was talking about is not included in this, nor does it account for the next generations who've been born here in the U.S. but will still self-identify as Nigerian or Egyptian, depending on what country they're coming from. But what I want to point out here is some of the concentration. Cities like Minneapolis and Columbus, Ohio, may have fewer African-born residents overall than bigger cities like New York, but the African-born populations make up a very high percentage of the foreign-born populations in those cities, more than 20%. And here we see this at the state level, and I think this is very important as a way to start talking about the Midwest and the Great Plains. There are three upper Midwest states that just dwarf the rest here, North Dakota, Minnesota, and South Dakota. They're well above the rest of the states in terms of the proportion of their foreign-born populations who are African-born. And Nebraska and Missouri show up on this chart not too far away. Kansas is just off of this chart. and we look at the levels of the settlement in different cities, we see, of course, the deepest colors, meaning the largest concentrations, are in the greater Minneapolis area, Columbus, Ohio. But then there are other places on here that show up quite prominently, like Fargo, or St. Joseph, or Sioux Falls. And then in a slightly less dense concentration, you see places like Lawrence, places like Wichita, and another place I'm going to talk about, Lewiston, Maine. When we disaggregate the African populations too, we see a diversity of where different communities can be found in larger numbers. There are significant Nigerian, Egyptian, Ethiopian communities everywhere on the map. But we see that the Nigerians' population totally dominates a city like Houston, also a majority of the, or plurality of the African population in Dallas, Chicago, or Atlanta, while Ethiopians dominate in D.C. By contrast, we see Minneapolis, a very large Somali plurality, as does Columbus or Lewiston, whereas Boston and Providence have the highest representation among Africans is of Cabo Verdeans. In Philadelphia, it's Liberians. In New York or Hartford, where I live now, it's Ghanaians who are the largest concentration. So this diversity and complexity takes on new manifestations within the United States. One last general point that I want to make, and it's really worth reiterating. Sub-Saharan African migrants to the U.S. and Africans overall, you notice the highest number on the chart over to the right, percentage of the population with bachelor's degrees belongs to Egypt. African migrants to the U.S. are taken as the most highly educated migrants streaming to the United States. Only for the Somali populations on this chart do we see a large proportion who have not been to high school when they come here. More than 40% of Africans who migrate to the United States have a bachelor's degree or higher when they arrive. For some countries, that number is more than half. Now I want to turn to some of the questions about what draws Africans to live in Midwestern cities and towns. And edging towards some of the stories that I want to talk about. From my own research and research projects of others, we can say some of the draw of the Midwest includes the lower cost of living compared to the bigger East Coast metros, but also the opportunity to establish oneself independently rather than being sheltered in an ethnic enclave in New York or Atlanta. Many Africans also appreciate the less hectic pace of life here in the Midwest in general, by way of comparison to these bigger cities. And many have a perception of the friendliness or religiosity in the region. But of course, it is family and social relationships, most of all, that bring them to this region. And I want to emphasize as well, at the same time, that but, it's a big but, at the same time, most migrants struggle mightily with those costs of living, with the highly individuated character of U.S. mainstream culture, the lack of support networks, their experiences with racism and bigotry unknown to them in their previous homes, and breakdowns in both family and gender dynamics and in social relations with fellow countrymen and countrywomen. So I want to give you a few stories along these lines. The first of these comes from where near to where I went to college, which is Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine. A rival up the Androscoggin River's Bates College in Lewiston. Lewiston's a town that is now more than 10% Somali. And I want to tell a little story about Ismail Ahmed, who began the Support Training Technical Assistance and Resources Agency, so that's a STAR agency, in the derelict factory space of Central Maine Power in Lewiston. 2007. His agency's goal is to help refugees become self-sufficient. He's a key advocate for the Somali community in Maine, but also a point person for conflict resolution. Like many Somalis in the U.S., he fled the country in the dire early days of the Civil War and famine, February 1992, and spent 7 years as a refugee in Kenya. Unlike many refugees, Ismail was fortunate enough to skirt the Kenyan authorities' hostility towards Somalis and to avoid resettlement in the massive refugee camps in Dadaab. Upon arrival in Atlanta, He worked three jobs at Pep Boys, Walmart, and a computer assembly firm to make ends meet. After struggling to understand the racial dynamics of the American South and lacking a college degree, Ismael surfed the web. He found an opportunity at the library at Lewiston Auburn College, graduating and then earning a master's there. In Lewiston, he says, "I've seen American life closely. I had my first Thanksgiving with a white family. I see big, extended families. There are closer families here than in Atlanta." This is a similar story to what I've heard in Kansas and Missouri. Yet at the same time, Ismael faces anti-Muslim, anti-Somali, anti-black attitudes in Maine as much or more than in Atlanta. With 3,700 Somalis in a town of 37,000, Lewiston has been forever altered by migrants like Ismael, and I would argue, much for the better. Chimamanda Adichie, in her 2011 PhD from KU, found that a great many of Kansas City's Somalis had arrived in the U.S. after years, even a decade or more, in Dadaab. Dadaab is actually comprised of numerous camps, designed in 1992 to hold 90,000 refugees. The five camps at Dadaab hold 500,000 refugees, arguably making it Kenya's third largest city. Kansas City Somalis, who lived extensively in Dadaab, not only endured the traumas of the Somali Civil War itself, they've also had to deal with the traumas of camp life, as detailed, for instance, in Ben Rollins' 2016 book, The City of Thorns, Nine Lives in the World's Largest Refugee Camp. These are traumas, hardship, and suffering that many Africans in America arrive with, nightmares which haunt them still. Of course, a great many Africans who come to the U.S. do not come formally or officially designated as refugees. The largest group of Africans in the U.S., as I've said, comes from Nigeria, which is far and away the largest country in African population terms, and amongst Africans in America. Given the long histories now for migration streams, a larger proportion of second-generation Africans in America are likewise Nigerian-American. Nigerians in America and Nigerian-Americans are highly educated, diversely distributed across the U.S., and engaged in a wide variety of professions. Nigerian communities include large numbers of Igbo and Yoruba, but also many other smaller ethnic communities. Yet even with a much stronger and deeper anchor in America now, with generally higher levels of education and income, the transnational experiences of many Nigerians can only be classified as ambivalent. Emo Okome's very personal rendition of this, entitled "You Can't Go Home No More, Africans in America in the Age of Globalization," showcases the way even a highly successful professor experiences the disjunctures. "Can I go back home to the Nigeria I left before coming to America?" she asks. "Never. Nigeria has changed. The economy went to the dogs and is yet to recover in a way that positively impacts the lives of the majority of citizens." At the same time, she says, "I've been in the United States for 30 years now. I've come to embrace the identity of a black woman in America. However, I would be fooling myself if I pretended that this political stance totally coincides with my emotional identity." So many Africans in the U.S. neither assimilate fully into American identities nor end up stuck in what are essentially dead-end ethnic enclaves. This is the advantage of transnational times. Transnationality, transnationalization are key dynamics of the everyday lives of African migrants in the U.S. These are ambivalent factors, however, as Okome suggests. One area of consistent challenge for this transnationalization has to do with relations between Africans and African Americans. There are certainly many success stories on both sides in navigating this relationship, but just as often challenges as Okome's story again suggests. I could talk more about stories of Ghanaians in Hartford or Senegalese in New York, as mentioned on this slide. Believe me, I could talk a lot about Senegalese wrestling. But in the interest of time, I want to move closer to home to talk some more about Kansas City and Wichita. First, I want to mention some East African communities, particularly Somalis in Kansas City, in relation to the Kansas African Study Center. CASC has had a great many wonderful experiences with the former Somali Foundation. And my own KU students have interned with the Kansas City Center for Urban Agriculture, which has helped many Somali farmers, as well as Jewish Vocational Services, which has been active in resettlement and job training. From these terrific experiences, I learned how hardships and the Dadaab camp figured very strongly in many people's experiences before coming here, only to have difficulties and hardships replicated in inner city Kansas City. But I've also seen how Somalis have successfully established themselves in the greater Kansas City area, a variety of jobs, in their own businesses, and community groups. Farah Abdi, for example, served as one of our principal inspirations throughout the period of our relations with the Somali community here. From 1999 to 2013, the Somali Foundation truly delivered on its mission, and I quote, to assist East African refugees and other immigrants to adjust socially to the United States and to live in economic security and good health by providing services, healthy living, education, and advocacy while honoring their cultures. But the Somali Foundation struggled with both financial and physical structural issues. This provides me with a major lesson for how vital it is for host communities to provide both financial and technical support to the fledgling organizations of Africans in the U.S., many of which face a similar uphill climb to that of the Somali Foundation. A second local example concerns Tanzanians in Wichita. As Byron mentioned, in 2004 to 2006, conducted research with two Tanzanian colleagues that were then at KU as well, Mohamed Dosi and Leonce Rushibirwa, with the Tanzanian Association of Wichita. I want to discuss our findings briefly. TaWichita, which was founded in 2001, sought to build community and assist the more than 300 Tanzanians residing in the area. Neither the organization nor the Tanzanian community can report smooth success. One of our themes in our published findings, we term educational dreams, bedpan realities. The majority of Tanzanians with whom we spoke came to the U.S. seeking higher education. Many found at least some of this at schools like El Dorado's Butler County Community College. A woman we called Teresa said, "Before I came here, I thought America was all good, life is easy. I thought America was paradise." But a great many ended up working as orderlies in nursing homes, barely making ends meet. A man we called Samuel told us, "After arriving, I've discovered there is money in America, but only after scraping for it. You have to work to eat. Life here means work. There is none of that life of good neighbors. It's just bills, bills, bills." Another finding from our study, which remains highly relevant, is that both transnationality and what we call translocality, the mobility, even transience of many Tanzanians along the I-35 corridor from Kansas City to Dallas, but in both directions, north and south of that as well. These are strategies for surviving in America. That doesn't mean that's the same thing as liberation or development. There is certainly a broad-minded cosmopolitanism, but there's also dislocation, loneliness, despair, and even occasional violence, such as the 2005 murder of an undocumented Tanzanian migrant in Dallas. Transnationality, in the minds of many of our interviewees, echoed the words of Donald Carter in his study of Senegalese migrants in Torino, Italy, as being, and I quote, "in a kind of passage, yet a passage that encompasses the possibility of never arriving, of drifting endless on the betwixt and between of the world's boundaries." Happily though, I can report that as of 2016, the Tanzanian Association of Wichita continues on as a self-help organization and a vehicle for communications across this transnational reality. They are constituent members of DIKOTA, the Diaspora Council of Tanzanians in America. Just this last weekend in Dallas, Texas, DIKOTA held its annual conference, and this was the title of the conference: Leveraging the Tanzanian Diaspora Capacity, Linking Growth, Opportunity, and Prosperity. It's hard to read about a conference like that with those themes and not think that there were African migration stories being told in Dallas last week that are richly in tune with America. Indeed, that are reshaping American identity to include communities like Tawichitani, substantively from the get-go, as part of the fabric of our country. We have a long way to go in the U.S. in simply learning from the stories of Africans in America, let alone in really rethinking sociocultural relations and histories to allow for that inclusivity. But my desire is always to seek hope, and I see it in the story of Dakota striving to move forward towards growth, opportunity, and prosperity.